From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition, and I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me, and thank you for helping end our summer fun drive. It ended earlier today. Coming up on the program, Governor Josh Shapiro signed Pennsylvania's budget into law on Sunday. That's 12 days after it was due, yet a full 4 months earlier than last year. What's in the budget? Well, Stephen Caruso and Jackson White of Spotlight PA will join us in the second half of the program to let us know. And we've got breaking news on ICE activity in New York State. As a college student detained earlier this month was released on bond. Plus, a Hudson Valley hamlet is fighting to keep its post office. For those stories and more, including an update on yet another very smoky day in New York State, I spoke to Lana Bellamy, editor with the Times Union Hudson Valley, earlier this afternoon. Lana Bellamy, welcome back to the local edition.
Hi, it's nice to be back as always.
Well, we've got a lot to talk about. We've got a few stories to get to, but first, I understand you've been covering some breaking news up in the Albany area, and it's related to ICE activity in New York. And it sounds like somebody who was detained earlier in the month is now out on bond. You want to tell us a little bit about this story?
Oh, yes. This is a pretty big story for us up here, and our Saratoga County reporter got the news today that a 22-year-old, he's a standout college baseball player for Savannah State University in Georgia. He had been detained by ICE while he was visiting his girlfriend in Clifton Park earlier this month, and we learned today that Johan Sandoval, which is the name of the man who was detained, he has been released on bond from his detention at the facility out in Batavia outside of Buffalo. He was detained while he was heading to the gym earlier this month. It was just part of his morning routine. And his girlfriend's mother, who witnessed the whole thing, she told us that that the ICE agents had sort of surrounded his car and asked for his identification. And when he went to provide them with information related to his student visa that he used to enter the U.S. in the early 2020s, the agents found that a form that his college in Albany, when he was going to school up here, had submitted for the visa had expired in April of last year. So agents continued that he had overstayed his visa, and they took him into custody.
Right. And now he is out on bond, but basically his lawyer is saying is that this is about a lapse in paperwork or a lapse of filing of information that isn't even his client's fault.
Right. So just how I was describing that this form that had been expired had been submitted on his behalf by the school in Albany in order to get his student visa. His lawyer is saying that the college in Georgia did not update the paperwork that was needed for him when he went to school down there. So his lawyer is arguing that it's really the college's fault, not Johan Sandoval, because he doesn't have access to this database that has to be updated. And his lawyer is saying so he had really no control over the situation. And his lawyer is also on that note arguing that he shouldn't be treated as a criminal, that this should be treated more as a civil matter that's related to records and paperwork.
Right, right. So is there any word from Sandoval and how he's feeling right now?
Oh, yes. Actually, my reporter is scheduled to have an interview with him later today, and he is supposed to tell her more about what his experience has been. His girlfriend's mother said that he was very worried about what it was going to be like to be detained, and he was like, pretty scared about, you know, how he might be treated in the jail, especially among other people who were detained there. So Wendy will talk to him, and we'll do another story.
Right. Well, this really is breaking news. So you're still getting the news and the information, and he has only just been released. So thank you for being on this, and we'll look forward to getting more information.
Of course. That's what we do.
Another big story in New York State today is the hazy, smoky weather and the unhealthy level, at least, you know, in the Hudson Valley and the upper Hudson Valley. That's kind of the rating today. What are you hearing about the smoke in the state?
Well, you know, further upstate in the capital region, it's pretty unhealthy for sensitive groups. But in the Hudson Valley, it's unhealthy for everyone, not just sensitive groups, unfortunately. But one of our reporters did talk to a meteorologist, and he said that we can expect the winds to shift the smoke south tomorrow, which may give us some relief. Not quite sure how much just yet, because he did note that we may still have some smoke on Friday evening. But the outlook has been looking much better for the weekend as a whole later in the weekend. So let's keep our fingers crossed for that.
Yeah, we'll always have to keep an eye on it, see which way the wind blows. But it's looking like it might be a little better tomorrow and then even better on the weekend. But there still may be some smoke appearing. Of course, we will keep you up to date here on Radio Catskill, whichever way the wind blows. Getting on to the next story. Well, as I understand it, the Hudson Valley Hamlet is about to lose its only post office, but local residents are pushing back on this.
Oh, yes. This was a really interesting one from our intern, Katie Andres. So this small hamlet in Ulster County called West Park, it only has one post office, and it's pretty interesting because these residents, they don't get their mail delivered directly to their home. So to lose your only physical post office location, which many of them have said that they actually walk to collect their mail, would be a disruption, to say the least, I think.
Right. I mean, the article comes with a picture where, like, it's a small community and it's a small group of folks. I mean, they've got signs and everything.
I know. So, you know, even though it was about 50 residents and local officials that showed up to a protest recently that Katie went to. And, I mean, for such a small community, that's a pretty good turnout for it. And they're really pushing back against it. And the backstory is kind of interesting, too. So the USPS has said that this is an indefinite closure that will start on July 24th. And the residents will have to instead now pick up their mail from the Highland Post Office, which is about 5 miles away. So for people who are used to, like, walking to the post office, you could walk 5 miles, but that's an awful long way to go just to get your mail. So even though they have said this is a temporary or indefinite closure, it doesn't mean that we've gotten any sort of timeline for when it could reopen. And the landlord for the post office location has said that it was forced to pull the lease for the building because it was having trouble negotiating a new lease for about a year and a half with the real estate agent for the USPS. So we're hoping to find out a little bit more about what's going on with that. Do they just need to negotiate a new lease? Will this pressure from residents and officials like U.S. Rep. Pat Ryan, will that help get the movement on the back end? We'll keep you all posted.
Right. We'll be looking forward to seeing that, too. Now, unfortunately, we do have some sad news because a small plane took off from Hudson Valley Regional Airport in Wappinger on Sunday. It flew north, and that plane never landed safely. It actually crashed. So now a local community is mourning the loss of the pilot.
Yes. His name was Kenneth Andrew. He was 74 years old, and he was from Mount Pleasant in Westchester County. And he'd taken off from the Hudson Valley Regional Airport, which is actually, he has a connection to it. It's where the Dutchess Community College's Aviation Education Center is located, and that is where he was a lecturer in aviation maintenance. So a lot of people are remembering him for his, being an instructor, but also a leader. So one of our reporters who have been following this story since we heard about the plane crash, they talked to the Civil Air Patrol, and they learned that Kenneth has served more than 30 years with the unit, which is a civilian auxiliary of the U.S. Air Force, and he served as the Southeast Group Commander and former Wing Commander. And so the Civil Air Patrol has also been saying that he was someone who was really dedicated to his service, someone who showed true leadership and commitment, and that, like, his impact was really felt, not just among, you know, the people he was teaching and leading, but in the greater community and beyond.
Yeah, and it's like he's kind of mourned by, like, communities within communities. I mean, there's a local community, but then there's the people that were involved with flying, whether that was at the college or, again, with the Civil Air Patrol, where he was a commander. Can you share the last statement from the Civil Air Patrol that they put out, the last quote there in the article?
Oh, sure, yes. Family, friends, and fellow members of the Civil Air Patrol and their thoughts. And so in a statement to us, they said, "Blue skies, Colonel Andrew. Your leadership, service, and legacy will continue to inspire those who follow in your flight path."
Thank you for that. These stories are all up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Lana Bellamy, an editor with Times Union Hudson Valley. Thank you so much for bringing us these updates.
Of course. Thank you.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
It is The Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, Pennsylvania's $50.8 billion state budget was signed into law by Governor Josh Shapiro on Sunday, nearly 2 weeks after the statutory deadline for the budget. And while it makes major investments in education, it doesn't fully address residents' concerns about skill games and data centers. For more on the Commonwealth's new budget, Radio Catskill reporter Rebecca Hendricks spoke with Jackson White and Stephen Caruso, Capitol reporters for Spotlight PA.
Welcome, Jackson and Stephen.
Thanks for having us.
So can you just give us a basic summary of the biggest changes this year from the budget last year?
So I think the biggest walk away from this budget is the investments in education. That's the biggest thing that was added in for lawmakers. There's an additional $900 million for education. And breaking that down a little bit more, there's $565 million to public schools that lawmakers have said are historically underfunded. That's actually the same number as last year, so a little carryover there. And it's just another step that lawmakers are saying is to build toward having equitable funding across the state for all of these public schools. There's boosts to basic education and special education, and there's even about $125 million that's being transferred to be used for school facilities. So that's kind of in line with last year. Education was another big win last year. But something sort of missing from this year that I think Stephen can break down a little bit too is, like, there aren't that many new proposals in here. Like, they're sort of incremental wins in these fights that have been going on for a long time. But lawmakers told us leading up to this budget deal that they were sort of avoiding some of the bigger partisan battles in the interests of getting a deal done as early as possible.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, we saw that in the fact that there is no minimum wage increase in this bill. There's very limited data center like wages in this bill. They did not address skill games. They did not legalize marijuana. There is no tax policy. Overall, the state's finances, where the state's spending more money than it brings in, remain where they were when this budget was first proposed by Governor Josh Shapiro. Even that number that you mentioned, the 50.8, as Jackson covered in a story today, is a low count of how much spending is actually going into it being spent in this year. For instance, a lot of that comes from $1.3 billion in payments to the state's Medicaid providers that are being just pushed back. This is an accounting trick that states done before, at least for probably starting about 2008. But then there's also pulling money from small off-budget accounts known as special funds. They've also been basically going into agency bank accounts and pulling out every dollar they can that was allocated previously and not used. you know, think about it like this, you know, that's basically making these agencies with paychecks a paycheck. So, you know, it is a way to use dollars that have been allocated, but, you know, down the line, this could eventually lead to some problems. I add this all up, and there's a lot that isn't done by this budget. And that's, I think, the reason that they got to a deal so quick.
There was some concern that with the kind of maneuvers that were made, some people criticized the budget for cooking the books, right? What does that mean for people living in Pennsylvania?
House Democrats say that the Medicaid maneuver, it's called a cycle roll, actually, just pushing these payments back a little bit. So they say that the cycle roll shouldn't impact day-to-day patients on the ground getting their payments from Medicaid, right? But I talked to the executive director at the Independent Fiscal Office, it's sort of like a research arm and a fiscal watchdog for the state. And they said that they do expect these organizations to expect some cash flow issues in the next couple of months, over the next 2 years even, because of these cycle rules. What that means, it's unclear. I tried to reach out to some of these organizations and I didn't hear back, but I'm hoping to keep trying to touch base with them to see what that impact will be. A lot of, you know, this maneuver brought in a lot of critics. So, you know, on the progressive Democrat side, they were saying that these delays are sort of like deferring these payments and deferring these different issues that aren't going addressed in this budget, or just delaying problems that they'll need to address in the future. And conservative Republicans still say that this budget spends too much because the $50.8 billion that you mentioned, the total, is still more than we bring in revenue as a state. So it sort of just angered a lot of folks across the state here. But hopefully on the ground, nothing has impacted with these Medicaid transfers.
And interestingly, on the Republican side, there was a big push to preserve this $8 billion rainy day fund. Why is that so important to Republicans?
I mean, I think it's important to Republicans because it's sort of their, you know, the Republicans are always, not always, Republicans are often going to show, present themselves as a party of fiscal responsibility. I think this $8 billion rainy day fund is a way to try and claim that, you know, to say that, like, this is a, you know, this is almost a representation of the state's solid fiscal stewardship. And then also a big account, bank account that big, it's going to gain interest, which is, you know, not nothing when you have $8 billion in the bank. We're talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars a year, potentially, in interest savings, which is helpful. You know, again, that's not nothing. Every penny counts with where the Commonwealth is right now. But, you know, you had some conservative Republicans, particularly, I think, the Freedom Caucus, which is the more right-wing faction of Republicans in the legislature, who did criticize this budget deal. Those are folks who voted against it. So, you know, I think that in many ways, it's sort of a win. It's a good talking point. But, you know, that fundamental structural imbalance that we've been talking about just still remains. And that's going to require some, either a lot of economic growth in the next couple of months, years, that can, you know, get rid of about $3-5 billion deficit, or the state's going to have to find a way to, you know, come up with those cost savings or raise taxes or a combination of all three.
And the budget addresses data centers, but maybe not as much as people expected. Can you break down for us how data centers factored into this budget?
Yeah, sure. The fiscal code, which is a trailer bill to the budget, basically just included that data centers will now have to report their annual energy and water consumption, which is, you know, not nothing. But when the both chambers, the Republican-controlled Senate and the Democratic-controlled House, they've been passing other bills that went even further, particularly the Democratic-controlled House, you know, a ban on NDAs filed by data center developers, you know, when they're signing deals with local governments, getting rid of a expensive tax exemption that data center developers could take, whereby if they're big enough and a lot would hit these marks, particularly the new hyperscale data centers, they could get they would not pay sales tax when they go buy computer servers or cooling equipment and whatnot for their developments. That was potentially going to cost, say, about $2 billion. All these things were discussed by lawmakers in the lead up to the June 30th deadline. They even, some of these passed one chamber or the other, but they never agreed on language. And despite a lot of back and forth and us hearing, you know, that it was in, it was out, it was in, it was out, the most that was included with these two transparency measures. So not nothing, but I think it's left some folks a little scratching their heads as to what happened, given all the bipartisan interest in this.
Yeah, and you mentioned that tax break for larger data centers. Was that popular with people within the state?
I'll just say, you know, I don't know if there's polling exactly on that, but data centers have earned a lot of bipartisan opposition, so much so that, you know, the bill is getting rid of them, passed with of close to 190 votes, near unanimous support, which is not something you often see, particularly on matters as weighty as tax policy in the General Assembly.
And something else that people were maybe expecting to see in this budget was some kind of regulation on skill games. Can you break down for us what is going on there with skill games and the ruling that happened in the state?
So earlier this summer, the state Supreme Court ruled in a case that skill games are essentially unregulated slot machines. Skill games are these, you know, those terminals that are popping up. People probably see them in bars, convenience stores, the W's, social clubs, that sort of thing. And the Supreme Court ruled that they are basically illegal slot machines that are unregulated, untaxed. So they gave the legislature until mid-October to change that ruling to say that they can exist and to regulate them in some capacity. Now, lawmakers have indicated for a long time that they want to tax these things. Governor Shapiro's administration estimates that if they did tax them at a certain rate, it could be about $2 billion in revenue. And that could go a long way toward a closing part of the deficit that we were talking about today, right? So there's a lot of interest here, but in the past couple of weeks, we've seen, especially on the Senate Republican side, Senate Majority Leader Joe Pittman has indicated that lawmakers might not address this. They might leave the court ruling to stand as it is, saying that they are illegal, which that'll leave these terminals subject to seizure from law enforcement. It is unclear what that'll look like. Some lawmakers have sort of expressed skepticism that, you know, local law enforcement are going to go and raid these convenience stores or anything, right, to take these terminals. So it is unclear what that would look like. But as of right now, they are illegal. Come mid-October, they're subject to seizure. And if the legislature doesn't act before then, that stands in place. When we asked Senator Joe Pittman in a news conference what the plan is here, what is next for that. And he basically didn't provide many details. He said that the court case could stand as it is, and lawmakers don't necessarily legally need to address it. But there is still interest on the House Democrat side in pursuing that.
And in the ruling, what were some of the biggest concerns that people had about these skill game machines?
Well, I'd say, you know, in general, the concern is kind of similar to the concerns about any unregulated gambling, that, you know, there's this element of, is it predatory? And there's just the simple fact that, you know, if a legal slot machine has to be in a casino minded by, you know, trained staff with video surveillance of the premises, you know, anyone under the age of anyone under a certain age can't get onto a casino floor. And, you know, but slot machines, or, you know, there's just known regulations for them, and they're taxed at almost 50, more than 50%. And that revenue then goes to the state. And, you know, some of that revenue goes trying to address social issues when it comes to gambling. And some of it, you know, just goes to helping the state pay for the rest of its bills. And that's not what skill games are. They were, their specific revenues were untaxed. And they are, you know, were just popping up all over the place. You know, there have been anecdotal reports that these things have been nuisances, if not public safety threats. There have been, you know, robberies over this. There was actually a lawsuit against the game developer, Page Nomadic, that from a family of a clerk who worked at a store that had one of them, who was killed by someone. I believe killed, maybe paralyzed. Maybe I should just go back and say, you know, there was a lawsuit over someone hurt who was a clerk in one of these stores when it was robbed by somebody who wanted to get his losses back from the machine. And all that's to say that, you know, all that's like kind of what's in a lawmaker's head as I consider this debate. You know, but as Jackson said, potentially $2 billion in revenue, some estimates are lower. That's a lot of money when the state is trying to, you know, flatten the couch cushions of bureaucracy, as our Majority Leader Joe Biden likes to say, to make sure the budget balances.
I wanted to go back to what we mentioned at the beginning with this budget being passed late. This is a common occurrence for Pennsylvania. Why is it that the state budget is often passed, you know, weeks after the statutory deadline?
Yeah, this is the fifth late budget in a row from Stephen Hess reporting so far. And really, it stems from a lot of partisan issues that the state needs to debate, right? It's part of it is heightened partisanship, just every party wanting to get their own wins policy-wise. Another piece of it from some of the experts and watchdogs that I've talked to is just that they don't start talking about the budget until it's, late down the line. I mean, they hold budget hearings in March, but I think any Capitol reporter will tell you that budget talks don't start in earnest until June. And that gives them until the end of June to get this done on time. There's also no pressure on lawmakers directly to finish it at that deadline. They still get their paychecks. State employees still receive their paychecks. It's really counties, schools, and nonprofits who are impacted by a late budget because they stop receiving their funding at a certain point. Now, f them finishing it within, 2 weeks or so of that deadline this year, they prevented a lot of the immediate harm there. Unlike last year, where we had 4 month impasse, schools, nonprofits, counties, they were taking out loans, they were suspending services because they weren't receiving money from the state, vital money from the state that they need because lawmakers couldn't reach a deal. And that's a lot of the conversation in the Capitol around budget time is like what sort of not necessarily incentives, but what sort of accountability should lawmakers have directly on themselves to make sure that these budgets are passed on time? Because it is statutory requirement, but it often in practice is just, it's sort of a joke in the Capitol at a certain point, whether they'll pass it by June 30th.
And what I'd add too is like as each budget gets late, even by a week, but sometimes by months, the ability for subsequent budgets to be late by even a few days gets worse and worse. Like because these school districts, because counties, because nonprofits are stretching or burning through reserves, they're then taking on loans when payments doesn't come through. They're then paying interest to the bank. They have other costs associated with that. That all adds up. So the ability of these agencies to weather even a few days without state funding coming or a few pay cycles becomes more and more difficult. I talked to the County Commissioner Association head who mentioned this to me that there are some counties that like already were starting to restrict services, and this was after 2 weeks. I think Harrisburg often, as Jackson noted, because there aren't these immediate consequences felt by state employees because people down the proverbial fiscal food chain. Because they're the ones who pay the price. It's easier to be out of sight, out of mind. And in past years, I've written lines. I've explained it that they can usually go a week or two without a deal, and it'll mostly be okay. And lawmakers themselves have leaned into that, saying if it takes us an extra week or two to get a deal we're all comfortable with, that's worth it if we get a good deal out of it. But just that leeway that fiscal give is just disappearing because of deal after deal after deal coming after June 30th.
That was Jackson White and Stephen Caruso of Spotlight PA. To learn more on this story, visit our website, wjffradio.org. In Liberty, I'm Rebecca Hendricks for Radio Catskill.
Well, thank you to Rebecca and Spotlight PA for that report. Thank you for being here with me on the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole. That's it for tonight's program. And thank you for helping end our summer fun drive. The outpouring of support that we had the past week and a half was phenomenal, heartening, and very necessary for the existence of this nightly news program. So thank you so much for your generosity. We got a quick reminder, a couple of reminders before we go. First is that the air quality advisory is in effect until midnight tonight. Smoky conditions may continue through the night. There will likely be some smoke tomorrow, but it's supposed to be better than it was the last 2 days. But do listen to Radio Catskill for updates on that. Coming up at 7, we've got Andy Carlson live spinning tunes for you for 2 hours on Ramble Tamble. Then at 9, it's special live coverage from NPR of President Trump's remarks on, quote, free and fair elections, as well as other subjects. Connect the Dots will return next week at its usual time. For now, you want to stay with us for The Daily here on Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR supported by listeners like you. And thank you so much for your support.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
Hey, it's Patricio. Thank you, thank you, thank you for your support during our summer fun drive. Thanks to you, we could keep making great local news for the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.